so much for agreeing to talk to me on the podcast. It's really an honor to talk to you, and I'm a great fan of your work. And I actually had a number of questions, but I also, those questions had to do with your work, which I think we'll get into in a minute. But I did want to start by asking you something that really intrigues me, having to do with your correspondence, which I believe began in 2014. There is a letter on the PLANS website, your correspondence with Yuri Avneri, and then your subsequent open letter 4 years later in 2018. It's a very telling correspondence for a number of reasons, but what struck me was that it encapsulates so much of the Palestinian perspective, which is easily buried in all of these conversations that we see online and all of the information that we see having to do with questions of one state, two state, and all of that sort of stuff that doesn't actually often center the Palestinian experience. We have books and books written by wonderful supporters, of course, non-Palestinian and Palestinian, obviously, but often what gets obscured, and I think now your work is so cutting edge in this way that it has always centered the Palestinian experience. And in particular, that correspondence with Yuri Avneri. And I just wondered if you could comment on that a little bit.
Well, first of all, thank you very much, Naila, for having me in this program. It's my first with you, and I hope it not be the last, but thank you again. Yes, the story of Yuri Avneri is very interesting from many points of view. He was always acclaimed as a prophet of peace. He went to see Arafat during the Israeli attack on Lebanon in 1982. And he had also good correspondence with him because he had a mission, self-claimed mission, that we should have peace with Palestinians. How and where and under what terms, this is what was not clear. A little bit about his background. He's a German Jew. His name was Helmut, actually. Uri Avneri is his adopted name when he came to Palestine. And he was member of the terrorist organization Irgun. In 1948, he was perched on a hill in a village called Huliqat, holding his machine gun. And he was watching masses of humanity from 240 Palestinian villages in the south, which has been depopulated by the Irgun and the Haganah in that time. And he, from that hill in Holigat, you could see the Mediterranean Sea and see masses of people, children, women, old people, are marching at gunpoint on the seashore, finally ending up in Gaza camps. And so he saw that. He says afterwards that he wrote something against that, but I don't think it was very effective. I met him in the year 2002, if I remember correctly, in a UNESCO function organized by the United Nations in Paris. And I was to speak on the Palestinian side, and he spoke about the Israeli side. Of course, conciliatory Israeli side. He was considered to be a man of peace. And we had a debate about the right to return, about the refugees. It did not conclude. And he said, well, let us continue this conversation over dinner. So I thought this an extension of our debate. And we had dinner together. And I asked him, what was your feeling when you saw the masses of humanity which have been made refugees under the muzzle of your machine gun? He said, well, it's war, and I'm sorry about that, but now we have to find a way to live together. I said, do you believe in right of return, that these people whom you expelled would have the right to return as United Nations and the law and logic and justice? He said, no. I said, how come? Supposing I have a house next to your house, not, you have not taken my house, but I have a house and you have legally taken the next house. Would you allow me, would you agree that I go back to my house, which is next to you? He said, no way, no way. I said, look, we are in Paris now. If you buy an apartment in a building in Paris, and the Frenchman say, I don't want a Jew living next to me, what would you say? Oh, we'll make a big fuss about that and we'll come, you know, complain and all that. He said, how could you? Here's a Frenchman saying, a foreigner, who I don't like him to live next door to me. How about me? I'm the original owner of the house and you are a new person. You have, of course, a war crime record. And he did not agree. So we had this discussion. I wanted to expose that in a series of letters. One of the things I said to him, you came with a gun. Your name is Helmut. You were an Aragon organization, terrorist organization. Don't you think you are a coward? He said, how come? I said, you are a coward. If you really came because of German persecution and killing, your job is to go to the Germans and try to defend yourself in your country with German. How come you go to another country which you have never seen before and kill defenseless people who never saw you and you never saw them? And one credit for this exchange in MondoWise is that the comments were about 260 comments, mostly from Jews. Mostly they are favorable to my position and criticizing him. And he was called the man of peace. From this story, I want to conclude one thing. There are many Jews who claim to be supporting peace in the Middle East. And they can vary from 0 to 100%. Meaning that their faith in justice in Palestine could be 100%, like Ilan Pappé, to people who are just paying lip service to that in order to justify what they had taken from us and what they made us as refugees. And their mantra is, all right, forget about the past and let us now live today, which means I killed your people, it's all right. I took your house, it's all right. I made you refugees for 72 years, it's all right. We have defamed you in the world and we told you, told the world that there is no Nakba and you are lying and that we are very small minority fighting against massive hordes of Arab savage who want to kill us, while the reverse is true. You came with 120,000 soldiers to depopulate our country from 560 towns and villages. So that's the story of Uri Avni. And well, I'm saying now that everybody who listens to or sees Jews calling for peace in Palestine, I would not put them in one category. They are different categories depending on one thing. I call it litmus test. I ask anyone who who says he supports Palestinian justice, do you believe in the right of return?
Right.
If the answer is yes, I talk with them.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they are just using a bit of propaganda.
That's a great way to do it, is to come back to the materiality of it and to stop swimming in this sea of ideology, which always brings us, of course, to this imperial mindset and this idea, this sense of entitlement, which I find extends into these conversations where, you know, the accusation of anti-Semitism is really, again, an implantation of European anti-Semitism into our story when it has nothing to do with us.
Absolutely.
Right. And so what's amazing to me is, for example, this implantation, this self-centeredness of that accusation of anti-Semitism, again, erases us. It's another act of erasure and of the Palestinian people. And so
This is the point I'd like to make a comment on. You know, this is now very well known anywhere who speaks about the rights of Palestinians, especially in Europeans and Americans and so on. He's accused of anti-Semitism, which is a stamp applied to them. Now, in about 40 years or more, speaking about Palestine, I don't really come to that discussion. It's not my discussion. My discussion is very simple. I was living with my family for 100 years in a place called Palestine. We were expelled by force of a gun. And until now, we are not allowed to return. This story, which combines expulsion and massacres and defamation and denial of rights, is undeniable, and it can be factually documented. So I don't have time to discuss other people's plights. The world is full of plights.
Right.
My duty first is to talk about mine. Mm-hmm. If that hurts some people, it's their problem. If that makes some people sympathetic to us, good for them. I don't have to deal with any other situation because we have nothing to do with it.
Right.
And we are only dealing with the situation in which we are today living in and with no end in sight. The crimes did not happen in 1948. They happened since then in what I calculate to be 25,000 days and nights. So it's continuous till today.
Yes.
So leave that aside. I'm talking about our plight, our rights in Palestine. That's what concerns me, and that's what I talk about only.
Right. What I'd like to talk to you about just for a minute is what happened on that terrible night when you were 11 years old and it was 3 o'clock in the morning. What happened that night? Can you just give us a summary of it? Because it's really harrowing and I think it needs to be told.
Well, on that night, we have an old woman of our relatives. She is a light sleeper. And she woke up and saw the lights, 24 lights from 12 armored vehicles in the night. It was like a monster with 24 eyes, piercing the night in the light of these tanks. And she screamed, "Jews are coming, Jews are coming." And I, for one, as a child, and most of all of us actually, I never saw a Jew in my life. I don't know what they look like. They told us they are around Jaffa. And they told us they came in ships and the British let them in. They told us that they have different languages and different shapes and different colors and all that. And they came to kill us. And the story of Deir Yassin was very well known. And so as a child, I said, "What? Who are these people? Why are they coming to destroy our life?" And of course, as you know later, it has been the mission of my life to do that. But these tanks came, and we have only about 15 young men with rifles. There is no way we could defend them. But we held them at bay till the next morning. And then they overcome us, and they destroyed our homes. They blew up the school, which my father built in 1920, and they burnt our houses, and they actually reduced our village to rubble, all of it. And that was in the morning of that day, 14th of May, in the afternoon of that day, Ben-Gurion declared his state. So he made me a refugee before there was something called Israel. Not only that, there is something else. Our school teacher was a nice young man. He's educated in Al-Azhar University. He's from a village called Burer, which is about 30 kilometers north of us. He was with us during this attack. Now, when he became a refugee, next morning, he knew that the night before our attack, his village, Burair, was attacked by a massive force with artillery, with tanks, and mortars, and they killed 125 people from the village of Burair. They went into every house, threw hand grenades at the family huddled in the next to a wall, and they then put all the village on fire. Because it is farmer's village, there was a lot of hay, and so the whole village was ablaze. Now, the irony of this, not only I became a refugee before Ben-Gurion declared his state, but when he declared his state, he made a statement. I have written the text of that statement in my book, but roughly it says he never mentioned to the massacre of Burair, which happened only a few hours before his speech, nor the massacre of Abu Shusha, which also took place a few hours before his speech. But he has the temerity to say, we call upon the Arabs of our country, meaning Palestinians, to resort to peace and peaceful means and do not attack us. Look at the irony. Someone who just finished the record of so many massacres, at least two of them the last 24 hours, would say, Palestinians, be peaceful. Be peaceful. Don't attack us. This irony is still going on today. We are portrayed as being the aggressors, when in fact we are the victims.
Yes, there is a concerted disinformation campaign and a demonization of Palestinians. And it's not just in relation to that historic event, but it's an ongoing situation because of the fragmentation of Palestinians, that this occurs, of course, everywhere where a Palestinian voice is heard. There's an immediate attack. And of course, it is the ethnicity that raises eyebrows. I mean, for decades to say that, immediately there was a chill in the air, you know, when this Palestinian identity was mentioned. And one of the things, I don't know if you have any thoughts on this, but there are theories out there having to do with, for example, there is one theorist, historian, Louis Fishman, who recently tried to say that Palestinian identity is something he likes to call Palestinianism, because the elites in the cities eventually tried to appeal to the peasants in the countryside, in the villages, to create this identity. And these kinds of fabrications go on in the literature, not only in the Zionist literature that declares itself Zionist, but even in the literature and the history books where, you know, there's no declaration of that whatsoever. There's an attempt to discredit us, and there is this ongoing campaign of disinformation.
Well, let me take up this point, which you brought up. It's a very interesting one. The Zionism waged 11 wars against us, and this is deep-rooted. One of them you mentioned, are very common, historically speaking, that they say Palestine is a land without people, and we are people without land, so it follows that they should go to that land because they have no land. In this story, they don't claim it is theirs, but they say they need a land. But the big lie that Palestine is a land without people is the most, what shall I say? I'm looking for an adjective. I mean, it's most damning lie that is propagated by people who know the truth. In 1919, let me go back a little bit. In First World War, the British and the French, they call them allies, they promised the Arabs if they help them in getting rid of Turkish rule of Arab provinces, they will help them to be independent free countries. While this was under the Sykes-Picot agreement. Well, Mr. Sykes, who is British, and Picot is French, were sitting in a room with a table in front of them. There was a map of the Middle East, and they were dividing the Middle East between them. Piece of cake. This is for you. This is for me. Publicly, their planes threw leaflets upon Arabs and saying, you will be free as soon as we win the war with us. All right. So this is in 1916. They entered the war. In 1917, the British managed, after some defeats, to take Beersheba on the 31st of October, 1948. And when the cable reached London, we took Beersheba on second of November, 1917. Balfour made his declaration, which he already agreed with the Zionist Jews before. Now, in 1919, there was something called Paris Conference, Versailles Paris Conference, in which the colonial powers who won the war sat down to decide the future of the countries which they have conquered. The Zionist Commission, which was established immediately after the Balfour Declaration, brought a map to the conference, Versailles Conference, of Palestine, map of Palestine, showing hatched over all the cities and villages, and writing on it, and I have a copy of that, writing on grazing land, shepherds only, pasture land, no cities, no places, no. And they said that the only shepherds come from Arabia and come and graze their, use this as a grazing and then go back. Now, this big lie was accepted by the League of Nations, and they confirmed the Balfour Declaration. Now, who actually confirmed that? The people who confirmed that are the British, who just 15 years earlier or 20 years earlier produced the survey of Western Palestine, which has 9,000 names in 12 volumes and 26 maps, where they are listing every single thing in Palestine in detail. The French were not far behind. The French sent Victor Gourin in 1865 and thereabouts. He wrote 7 volumes about the villages of Palestine, describing each one with maps. The Germans were not far behind. In 1850, Van der Velde, there's a Dutchman, and Kiepert, which is a German, produced detailed maps of Palestine. So those who agreed with the Zionists that Palestine is a land without people knew very well it's a big lie, and they have full documentation of it. Now, build on that to say that the 11 wars of Zionists waged against us, one a question of knowledge, the other one erasing our history, or erasing our geography, destroying our archaeology. Politically, they are waging a war against us, economic war against us, and all that. So this war is still going on. And I'm personally amazed that people who read books at the time when we have, you know, TV and communication, how come this simple and basic and well-documented information is denied to be known by the Western public? This is something which every person in the West should ponder. Why am I not allowed to know the truth? And who is afraid of the truth? Obviously, the criminal is afraid of the truth.
Now, that's right.
We have a secondary conclusion, ICC, the International Criminal Court, the Israelis and the Americans are dead against it. And I say, really, simply, why? If you are innocent, well, go ahead and say you are innocent. Why do you want to kill the judge and the court instead of going to the court and proving you're innocent?
Yeah, it's shocking. Yeah. You know, you don't even have to go. I collect these old antique travel guides, and this handbook. One is 1898.
Yeah.
And of course, if you look through, it's full of maps, full of details of the villages, everything, right? Like they're pull-out maps. Yeah. The first volume of this was produced in 1876, Baedeker's Palestine and Syria.
Yeah, 1876, you're right.
Yeah, and so that, and this one is 1898. I bought it in the 90s, in the early 90s, in an antiquarian bookshop for $65. It's a beautiful book, but as you read through it, what's very interesting, okay, besides the fact that it has all those maps that they ignored in 1919, but when you look through the and you actually read what it says, they very much rely on Old Testament Bible stories to talk about the geography and the places and the place names. They put the Arabic name, but then they also talk about it. And I was asking a friend about this, and she said it's really ignorance, but this is how this Old Testament reliance of Zionism has perpetuated as well, is that people really think that those Bible stories are true, and they want to know where the Bible story happened. And so this also is a way for them, for this to continue, this to generate the lie of what the geography tells us.
Yes. Well, there are two currents in this one. One is under the name of biblical studies, which has been the purpose of Palestine Exploration Fund survey, which I mentioned. And this was intended to prove the geography of the Bible. But if you read it, and my atlas, which appeared last summer, is about that, 700 pages, you will see they were trying to recreate the Crusaders' imagery of Palestine. Right. And they were trying to find in every single stone a proof that this doesn't belong to Palestinians, it belonged to other people. I don't know who they are. And then the Zionism came, and they wanted to use that data to show that Jews were there at the time, and after 2,000 years, European Jews who have nothing to do with Palestine decided to come, you know. And this is intended to create a fictitious image. There is a man called Patrick Wolfe. He is a great scholar of colonial, settler colonialism. Well, he says, and we know this, but the way he phrased it is a very good one. He says that settler colonialism used the word terra nullius about any country they take, meaning that a country without people, but what they actually mean, even if there were people, they are worthless. And therefore, we really should kill them, destroy them, obliterate them, and so on. And so the aim of settler colonialism is first to take the land and to eliminate the people, either by genocide or by denying them records or denying or falsifying history and geography. So it is the same pattern, very clear. Unfortunately for them, Palestinians are here to stay. They are now 13 million. Half of them are Palestinian soil. Of course, Palestinians in Palestine and outside are victims of Israeli apartheid, which is now known publicly. Even Israel now declares itself a national state of Jews. And then there is the Salem report about apartheid Israel everywhere in Palestine. But this was known for a long time. The treaties, the committees of the United Nations have written about that years ago. Last one in April 2017, UN office, ESQA, produced a report. And then the pressure of the Israelis made the United Nations bury the report. So anyone who would like to see this, we just switch on the TV or read the net information that was available. Who is denying it is the one who is perpetuating the crime.
Right. Yeah, and it's interesting that it was only after the Israeli a human rights organization, B'Tselem, came out this year with their statement that it was aired on mainstream media, because that other report from 2017 was completely removed, was completely squelched. And it's only it's only okay for them to do it because of it's an Israeli organization that has, you know, published this report.
Well, so I call this racism, Naila.
Very telling.
Racism, meaning that any information from the victim is not to be counted. And only if the Israelis say something, then it's worth listening to.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, this is what I call racism.
Exactly.
In the 1980s, a new so-called Israeli historians found their way to unclassified Israeli reports about Nakba, about the massacres committed in Nakba. And they wrote about them. And people hailed this as a great success of and discovery. But we tell them, we told them this from 1948.
Yeah.
All the time. Every refugee in 1948, anywhere in Palestine, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, we carried the story of what these books wrote about 40 years later. So that tells you the silencing of the victim is one crime which is going on until today.
Yes. And that is why it's your work has been so important, because it documents with scientific study, for example, the trajectory of the return. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about, I know that last year, I believe the winning entry into the architectural competition was for the village of Kula. And you discussed this a little bit. And I just wondered if you could run through, like, sort of what is involved in these urban plans for the regeneration, for the return, but also the for the regeneration of the destroyed villages.
Thank you for asking. I would like to say a few things about that. My first atlas and maps was based on the British Mandate survey of Palestine, capital S and capital P. Survey of Palestine. During the British Mandate of 30 years, they produced hundreds and thousands, actually, of maps about Palestine. They really describe every place in Palestine by correct and scientific survey means. So, but that was scattered around and not known. So I made a search of libraries in England France and Germany, United States and the United Nations. From that, I created the map of Atlas of Palestine, 1917 to 1966, meaning from First World War to 1948 until the year just before 1967 war. And in that atlas, I have four chapters. It's 700 pages. It's full of data. Let me just say something before I continue. Not an Israeli university or professor disputed any part of it. Although they scoured every page and they looked at everything, they couldn't. Benny Morris wrote three articles about that, could not find anything wrong. Now, in this atlas, I have four chapters. The first one, how Palestine before the mandate and how the mandate came. The second one, Palestine land and people. The third one, is a Nakba, how it was carried out, step by step, every 2 weeks, how many land they have taken, how many villages they depopulated. And the fourth one, in the aftermath, what happened to the refugees and how, where are they now, and so on. The following work, which I have done, is to devise the return plan. We have a huge database. We know every single kilometer of Palestine, what it was and what it is today. And we know the people of the village, their land, where is land. We know their names. We know in which refugee camp they are today. And we said then, let us see how they can return. Because the international law, Resolution 194, is for it and repeated 135 times. So the first question is, say, if the international laws apply and the people return, who are the people they will find in their place? In their villages, in their land, and so on. And we found a startling result, which again is a victim of the Israeli silencing. People never talk about it. We found that Israel, the land of the rural villages, is still empty today. The 87% of Israelis live in 12% of Israel's area in three areas, West Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, Jaffa, and Haifa. The rest are either almost empty or have few kibbutzim. And the kibbutz and the moshav comprise only 1 to 2% of Israelis. So the return of refugees is feasible, it's legal, and it's possible. We even calculated how long it will take from a refugee camp in Jordan or Lebanon. The maximum distance is 60 kilometers. In Gaza, they don't need cars or trucks or anything. They just walk. We calculated even how many buses they need, what cross section, and all that. We also, part of this is your question. We created an architectural competition among young Israeli architects about to graduate. This year, we have 66 students submitting their designs.
Not Israeli students. Sorry, you said Israeli students, not Israeli.
Yes. Yeah, oh. All right. Now we are in the fifth year of the competition. We invite universities from Palestine and from neighboring countries like Lebanon and Jordan. We also invite young Palestinian architects who are in England or America. They can participate as individuals. And this year we have 66 students participating. Each year we give them a list of 10 villages. They select one. We give them a full report about the village, its aerial survey, its maps, who were they, what they did, their history, their geography, how they were expelled. And we tell them, redesign the destroyed villages now with 10 times the population, with electricity, with internet, with all that. They did wonderful job, these young people. Then we did something else. If they have the winning design last year was for a village called Suhmata. Suhmata is in the north in the Galilee. And we said, this great work, by the way, this work is judged by an international jury in London. Almost all of them are not Palestinian, only one or two maybe. So we said, this great work should be known to the people of Suhmata. So we held a Zoom meeting in the Lebanese refugee camp of Suhmata people. And they sat together on the webinar, talking to the young people, what did you do with our well? Where is our school? How do we get to here? Where is the house of Sheikh Abdullah? And of course, it was one room school, you need now four or five schools and so on. And they asked questions and they were beautiful. We made a point in these meetings about Suhmata people. We repeated this for five villages, that not only the old people who knew Suhmata, but their children and grandchildren who will inherit that. They were present. And those young people said, well, I need playgrounds here. And I need a place where we have connection with our relatives who are abroad and so on. It was wonderful experience.
That's amazing. I'm getting a little choked up by this. This is so beautiful. I just love this idea. And I can imagine that must have been an incredible experience for everybody involved. Where exactly is the village? Is it close to the border or is it?
No, we have 500 villages depopulated.
Yes. Yes.
So we have a database for all of those. Each year we select 10, and we in the selection, we try to make the 10 from north, south, and the middle of Palestine.
Right. And so that one was in the Galilee.
That one was Galilee. We had one for Burair in Gaza. We had people of Burair attending to see how their village was rebuilt after the massacre.
Yeah,
we have one from Ma'lul and so on. We repeat that, I hope, this year.
Yeah, right. So I did want to ask you as well about some of the research that you undertook at the International Committee of the Red Cross in Geneva and what you had discovered there.
Well, it's a very interesting story, a sad one, in fact, and very illuminating story because it really destroys many of the myths which are propagated against us. In 1994, I read that ICRC or the Red Cross has opened their classified files during the war before, which is Second World War and before. And the reason they did that, there was a lot of pressure from Jews in Europe, accusing them that they are hiding files incriminating Germans and they are not showing them. They opened their files. So I went there, spent a week, said, what do you have in Palestine? And I found that in 1948-49, in this period, they were opened an office in Palestine and they were witnessing a number of, in fact, all the events, but also witnessed some of the massacres. One of the things I noticed that they were visiting concentration camps of Palestinians. And they converted them into forced labor camps. And they have reports, of course, in very dry Swiss language, actually French language. And they are saying that when Israelis, they were called then Haganah militia, attacked a village, they killed anywhere from 20 to 200 people from the village people. Then they took the children, from the children, age of 15 or less, to maybe 50 or 60, took them in trucks and put them in concentration camps. Then they put them to work. If anyone doesn't work, they will shoot him. They will stay a day or two without food and water. What their job was to bury the dead, to dig trenches for the Israeli forces, to carry the loot from Arab homes, and such things. And there were distinguished people from those who are taken, like Yusuf Sayegh, the great Palestinian economist. And these reports, I took 500 pages, I photocopied them, and I published them in Journal of Palestine Studies in the year 2014. But before I did that, I said, let me find people who actually have been in these camps. And I found 24 people. And they were scattered. They were in Haifa under Israel. They were in the West Bank and in Jordan, in Syria. And after a passage of maybe 50 years from that time, they told me the same story and they did not know each other. It was corroborated perfectly, perfectly.
Amazing.
What is strange about this? They put them to work and anyone who didn't not work, they will shoot him. And they stayed there from up to 2-3 years. Then they were released. When I interviewed the survivors, I found that not only there were 5 concentration camps visited by Red Cross, but there were 17 others. The Red Cross have never seen them. They converted old police stations or old house into a concentration camp. And they would have the floor in sand so that when they beat them or injure them, the blood will not spoil the floor. They will be soaked in the sand. The amazing thing about that is that this took place only 3 years after the German concentration camps were closed. And the commanders, the Jewish commanders of these concentration camps in Palestine were German Jews. They have the names of Molman, Schneider. We have the names. Red Cross put their names. So it is a story which must be told everywhere.
I hope the Red Cross is available information. It's not being suppressed, but some historian has to tell that story.
Well, they are still there to my knowledge. And I know that when we opened the door, some people took notice of that and they went there. They are still there. I don't think they will close the door again. No, I don't think so.
Thank you.